Turn in your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 16. This morning and probably next Sunday, I want to speak on the life of King Ahaz. King Ahaz was a king of Judah. He was a bad king of Judah. There were a lot of good kings in Judah's history, and there were some bad ones. And then in Israel's history, there were mostly bad ones, and there was maybe a good one here and there. If you'll remember the history of the nation, King Saul, first of all, reigned over the entire nation, and then King David reigned after him, and King Solomon reigned after him. And then when King Solomon passed the kingdom down to his son Rehoboam, his son was a fool, and he ended up having a revolt of 10 of the tribes. The northern tribes broke off and became a separate nation. And that nation was called Israel, sometimes called Ephraim. And the southern nation was called Judah, and its capital was Jerusalem. And there were two tribes down there. There was the tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Judah. King Ahaz was the king of Judah, the southern tribe, which was really the Lord's nation. Israel had been pretty well cast off. They weren't gone yet. They were still around, but they were pretty much there to plague the nation of Judah. Why I wanted to get into this study is I was reading in my daily Bible reading in the book of Isaiah in chapter 7, and you don't have to turn there, we'll maybe get there next week. And as I was reading through Isaiah chapter 7, it discusses the time of King Ahaz, and Isaiah's dealing with Ahaz and his prophecy to Ahaz. And as I was reading through that, I thought, boy, that would make a really good sermon, because there's just a lot of lessons that could be drawn out of this. And so I kind of made a mental note of that, or maybe even a physical note, and I went back to it recently and thought to maybe just do an extemporaneous sermon on that. And as I got looking into it some more, I went back to 2 Kings 16 and 2 Chronicles 28, and those are parallel accounts of the life of King Ahaz. And I got reading about the life of King Ahaz, and honestly probably had forgotten a lot of these things, because there are so many kings back there, sometimes you get all the details of them confused and you forget the less significant ones, especially the bad ones. But I got reading through this, and I thought, boy, this would be there's a lot of good stuff here, a lot of things that I can talk about. So I decided to go through this. I don't have any notes for this sermon, so it's not exactly extemporaneous, because extemporaneous means without notes or preparation aforetime. I certainly have prepared a lot, and I do have a lot of verse references written in the margin of my Bible, so it's not exactly without notes, but I don't have a formal outline for it, so I'm hoping and praying that the Lord will give me grace and strength and wisdom to be able to bring out the things that I want to bring out, not forget some of the things I want to talk about. So like I said, King Ahaz was a king of Judah. He came after King Jotham. There in verse 1, 2 Kings 16:1, it says, In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Now Pekah was a king of Israel, king in the northern kingdom. Pekah was a wicked king, which if somebody gave you the name of a king of Israel and said, was he a wicked king or a righteous king? Just say wicked, because chances are there was hardly any righteous ones, and more than likely you're going to be right. It's like a multiple choice test with 10 answers and 9 of them are correct, right? So you have a pretty good chance of just picking one. With the nation of Judah, it's more good than bad. I don't remember. I've gone through them all before, but I don't remember the exact percentages. So anyway, Ahaz reigns after Jotham. And this is interesting because Ahaz was a bad king sandwiched between two good kings, because his father, Jotham, was a good king. If you just look up a few verses there in 2 Kings 15:32, it says, in the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, began Jotham, the son of Uzziah, also known as Azariah, king of Judah, to reign. 25 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. So you had here at least a couple of good kings that had preceded King Ahaz. This is extremely sad when you've got a couple of good kings. So his grandfather was a good man, his father was a good man, and then he turns out to be a dud. And that's pretty sad, isn't it? But then the interesting thing about this is that his son was Hezekiah, and probably most of you are aware of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was one of the best kings in Israel. And it's not very often that a dud has a really good kid that really does great things, right? Usually duds breed duds, right? Sometimes good people breed duds, but duds don't normally breed good people, right? It usually doesn't go that way. But this was the case with Hezekiah. You look in chapter 18, 2 Kings 18, in verse 1. Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. 25 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name also was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah, and he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. So Hezekiah, being the descendant of a wicked king like Ahaz, did that which was right. So maybe he looked back to his grandfather. What was his name? His grandfather Jotham, maybe his great-grandfather Azariah, and many grandfathers back, King David. He did after the good ways of the Lord. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes kids of horrible parents don't want to follow in the footsteps of their parents, and they determine, you know what, I'm not doing that. I am going to go in a different direction. And maybe that's what happened with Hezekiah. So Ahaz was a bad king between two good kings. He was a bad king that came from a good king. And you think about that. It says in Proverbs 22 and verse 6 that if you train up a child in the way he should go, he will not depart from it. Remember Proverbs 22, 6? Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. So here we have a good king, presumably a good father. He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, and the right thing to do in the sight of the Lord is to train up your children and bring them up in the ways of the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So presumably Jotham brought up Ahaz in the way that he should go, but Ahaz departed from it. You think about that. But we don't want to just conclude because of that Jotham was a bad father. And you don't want to necessarily conclude that because parents have kids that go astray that they're bad parents. Now, it could be parenting, it could be the fault of parents, but, you know, it could also just be that their kids are just jerks and do their own thing. God himself had a few bad kids, and I don't think anybody is going to accuse the Lord of being a bad father. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 2. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 2. Isaiah 1:2 says, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me." So here's the Lord, the best father anybody could possibly ask for. He nourished. Remember, fathers, bring up your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. He nourished them, and he brought them up. He raised them, and they rebelled. Sometimes that happens. Back in Deuteronomy 21 and verse 18 through 21, there was provision here made for parents that brought up their children in the way that they should go, and the children were just stiff-necked, hard-hearted, rebellious kids, and they wouldn't listen, and there was a provision made for that. And Deuteronomy 21, 18 says, "If a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father, and the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him, will not hearken unto them." See, they did what they were supposed to. They chastened him, they disciplined him, and he still wouldn't heed. "Then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out unto the elders of the city and unto the gate of his place, and they shall say unto the elders of his city, This our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die, so shalt thou put evil away from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. So there was provision in the law for good parents that brought up bad kids, that you can take care of that. You get rid of those kids. And my guess is, if those laws were obeyed, there were probably not very many rebellious and stubborn, drunkard, gluttonous kids in Israel. Because if you knew that you are going to be stoned, and that would not be a pretty way to die, you would probably clean up your act a little bit. If not for godliness, just for self-preservation. So Ahaz was one such kid. 2 Kings 16 and verse 2. It says, 20 years old was Ahaz when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and did not that which was right in the sight of the Lord his God, like David his father. I hadn't really looked at this before. He was 20 and he only reigned 16 years, so that's 36 years old. I don't know if... I'd have to look at this. See, that's the problem. When I don't have an outline, I don't look at everything. But if he died, just says there, and then the end of the chapter, now the rest of the acts of Ahaz which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Ahaz slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Hezekiah his son reigned in his stead. So yeah, it looks like he died at 36 years old. You know, it says that bloody and deceitful men shall not live out half their days. It says that in the book of Psalms. So there's a guy that basically lived out about half of his days. 36, right? 72 would be twice that much. So that's about the average age when somebody dies. So yeah, he did not live a long life. How many verses in Proverbs? Which I don't have an outline, so I can just do whatever I want. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 3. Just reminded me, Proverbs chapter 3, where we read that long life and peace comes to they that obey the Lord's commandments. Proverbs chapter 3, 1 through 2, he says, "My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments, for length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee." Well, we are going to see in the life of Ahaz that he did not get any of these things. He did not get long life, 36 years. That's certainly not long by anybody's measure. Peace. He didn't get peace. He had a lot of war. Long life and peace shall they, and length of days shall they add to thee. So when you keep God's commandments, by and large, you're going to live a long, peaceful life. When you don't keep God's commandments, your days will be cut short. And this was the way it was with King Ahaz. It says there that he, in 2 Kings 16:2, and did not that which was right in the sight of the Lord his God, like David his father. He did not that which was right in the sight of God. One of the reasons why I wanted to cover the life of King Ahaz is because he was a bad example. And you'd think, well, why would we want to cover bad examples? Shouldn't we want to cover good examples and we'll learn what to do from good examples? What do we want bad examples for? But you know, there are many lessons that we can learn from the wicked. Many. As a matter of fact, and I'm going to make my case for this. I'm going to make my case for it biblically. I'll show you we can learn lessons from the wicked. And I'm going to make my case with a couple of examples, and I think you're going to see it crystal clear that we actually probably learn more profound lessons from bad examples than good. I've had a lot of good examples in my life, in my Christian life, and I've had plenty of bad examples. And I have learned from both. I've learned a lot of good things from good examples, but I've learned a lot of things to not do, to stay away from, to avoid from bad examples. And I'll give you some examples here, not real life examples, but I'll give you some hypotheticals that we'll really drive this home to you in just a second. But before we do that, turn to Proverbs 21 and verse 12. Proverbs 21 and verse 12. So there's a lot of benefit that we can derive from studying the life of a bad king. Why do you think God puts all these examples of bad kings, bad people, wicked doings? There's a lot of bad stuff in the Bible, right? Tons of accounts of people that did terrible things. Why do you think God put him in there? For our admonition, for our learning, right? That we can learn what not to do. And this is what Solomon tells us here in Proverbs 21 and verse 12. It says, "The righteous man wisely considereth the house of the wicked, but God overthroweth the wicked for their wickedness." So a righteous man wisely considers the house of the wicked. God doesn't tell you to don't you ever look at that house of the wicked. Just keep looking straight ahead. Don't even glance over there because you don't even want to see that. No, God says, you know what? A righteous man will wisely consider that house. He doesn't want to emulate it. He doesn't want to follow that example, but he's going to look at it and consider. He's going to think and ponder and see, boy, I see how these wicked people live, and that is not what I want to do. We turn in Proverbs, just over a few chapters, to Proverbs chapter 24. Here's an example of paying attention to a bad example and learning from a bad example. Proverbs 24, 30 through 34. Solomon said, "I went by the field of the slothful, and by the vineyard of the man void of understanding. And lo, it was all grown over with thorns, and nettles had covered the face thereof, and the stone wall thereof was broken down. Then I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction." See, most people would just look at that and say, "Look at that pigsty. Man, that is just so disgusting." And they just keep on driving by. They wouldn't even want to think about it. But Solomon looked at something like that, looked at a guy that was lazy, and he just wasn't mowing his grass, he wasn't taking care of his house, and the place just looked like a total dump. And rather than just passing by and saying, "Man, that guy's white trash," he looked at it and thought about it for a while. He learned something from it. "Then I saw and considered it well. I looked upon it and received instruction. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and I want as an armed man." So Solomon looks at this and says, yeah, I don't want to be like that guy, that instead of mowing his grass, he's sleeping all day long, right? He's not taking care of his house. It says, by much slothfulness, the house falleth through. And have you ever seen a house like that? You ever see a house on an old road somewhere, and it's just falling down, like the one in front of Don and Karen's house, right? The house is just falling down because somebody moved out of it, and then they built another one and never, you know, you don't keep it up. And that's what happens. I mean, every house, you look at the most beautiful new house, and if you do nothing with it, it'll just fall down. And it's amazing how quickly they'll fall down. And you think most people, you don't really see them doing repairs regularly to their house. They're just kind of living in their houses, and it just seems like the house just continues on and everything goes fine with it. But I'm telling you, you move out of there and that place is going to fall down in no time. It's, you know, people that have nice looking houses, there's a reason for that, right? They're putting time into it. They're keeping them up. And so anyway, Solomon looked at this and received some instruction and realized, boy, I don't want to do what that guy did. I'm going to be in bad shape. But let me just prove to you here about how bad examples are so much more powerful than good examples. And we need both of them in our lives. But let me just take the tale of two different guys. Let's say you know one guy and he never did drugs a day in his life, right? Never did any kind of illicit drugs whatsoever. And he was sober and he had a great family. He had a beautiful wife. He had beautiful children. And he had a good job, he worked hard, and just had a great life. Very happy, wasn't depressed, wasn't on, you know, having to make trips to the emergency room and things like that because he's all sick and so on. You could look at a guy like that and say, boy, that's a good reason for me not to do drugs, because this guy's got a wonderful life. And somebody might look at a guy like that and conclude, he didn't do drugs, therefore, you know what, I really don't want to do drugs. But chances are, most people are not going to look at a guy like that and walk away with a profound lesson that, you know what, I do not want to do drugs. But now, let's say you know another guy, and he started doing drugs when he was in high school. And then he got into harder drugs, and before you know it, he's addicted to heroin. And he's shooting up heroin all the time. And he's just totally whacked out of his mind. He's totally useless. He can't hold down a job. His wife has left him. His kids are left in shambles. He's totally hooked on this stuff. He loses his job because he can't hold one down. And then he goes out after he loses his job, and he still has to get his fix, so he starts stealing from people and starts selling drugs himself, maybe. And you look at the guy's face, and he looks 30 years older than he is. and you look at a guy like that, and then he dies of an overdose. You look at that, and I guarantee you, the first thing you are going to think is, I do not want to end up like that. I am not going to take drugs. Which person made a more profound impact on you? The good example or the bad example? The bad one, obviously. What if you know a guy, just to give you another example, what if you know a guy that has never committed adultery, he's never flirted with another woman, he's been totally faithful to his wife. He's got a wonderful wife, she loves him, he's got beautiful kids, wonderful home, his kids are happy because they see that the parents are happy together, and you look at that guy and you'd say, I want to be faithful to my wife. That's such a good example. I want to follow his example and be faithful to my wife. That could happen, right? But what about if you know another guy, and this guy's running around on his wife, and he's flirting with every woman at the office, and he's having adulterous affairs on the side, and he gets caught, and his wife divorces him, and his children's lives are ruined, and he's got a venereal disease from all of his sinful living, and the guy just, his life is in shambles. I guarantee you, you're going to look at that guy and say, I do not want to do that. I do not want to commit adultery. I do not want to be unfaithful to my wife. See how the bad example is far more powerful than the good example? We need them both, of course. But I guess if there have to be sinners in this world, I guess I'm glad that God at least allows them to be here for a purpose, to stand as a warning to the rest of us to not go where that person went. Due to my strange sense of humor, I love the website called despair.com. And despair.com, you should check it out sometime. They make demotivational posters. You've seen the motivational posters, right, that every office has. If I was ever a company owner, my office would be full of demotivational posters because I think they're hilarious. And they make fun of all this motivational crap. But anyway, I love these things. My wife got me a calendar for my birthday or something one year. And then I took all of the posters on the calendar and cut them out perfectly and put them in 11 by 14 frames and framed them up all over our apartment. And I have one in the hallway, and it's a picture of a ship that half of the ship is sticking up out of the water. It's sunk. And it says that it may be that the purpose of your life is only to serve as an example to others. And I thought, you know what, there's a lot of truth in that. I think some people's lives, that's pretty much their purpose, is to serve as an example to others, to not follow in their footsteps. So this is the reason why I think it is necessary and important and profitable to study the life of King Ahaz, of a bad king. We haven't even gotten into why he was a bad king yet, but we will. 2 Kings 16 and verse 3. 2 Kings 16, 3. It says, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and made his son to pass through the fire according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and that was his problem. The kings of Israel were wicked kings, starting with the first one, King Jeroboam. Once the nation split and the 10 tribes went off on their own, they were ruled by a man named Jeroboam. We'll get into Jeroboam here maybe next Sunday, I think. This may be a two-parter, could even be a three-parter, I don't know. You're smiling at me now. But it could be. It's so funny, I'm listening to the sermons. I've been posting the sermons on the Pastor Wagner site as well. I'm doing like 5 of them a day. And so I listen to the first few seconds of them to make sure that I have the right sermon attached. It never fails. Every series, oh, I'm going to be preaching on this for the next 2 or 3 Sundays, and the series is 7 or 8 sermons long. And it's over and over again. So anyway, he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. This was his problem. He had bad examples that he was following. You know, we're told in Scripture that evil communication corrupts good manners. That's in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33. It says, be not deceived. So this is one of those things that people deceive themselves on. You remember the sermon, the series on deception, the one that was supposed to be 3 or 4 sermons long. Remember that one? It was like 18 or something. But anyway, be not deceived. Evil communications corrupt good manners. A lot of people think, and especially young children, or adolescents, I should say, teenagers, they think that they can hang out with friends that are bad kids, and it'll be okay. They're not going to corrupt them. They won't change them. As a matter of fact, I may be able to let my goodness rub off upon them, and I will change these other little devils into good little saints. Right? That's what people think sometimes. But be not deceived. Evil communications. Now remember, communications is your manner of life. So if you are around people in your life, observing their way of life, and you get too close to them, they will corrupt your good manners. Let's look at another one in Proverbs chapter 13. Proverbs 13 and verse 20. You see, Ahaz, it appears, spent a little bit too much time with the kings of Israel, learning from them and going after their ways. Proverbs 13 and verse 20. Says that he that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. See, if you walk with wise men, their wisdom can be a positive influence on you. And if you're a wise person yourself, then iron, as iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend. So a wise person spending time with another wise person will make him the yet wiser. But a wise person spending time with a foolish person will end up destroyed. They will bring you down. And a foolish person spending time with a foolish person is on a fast track to destruction because he's already halfway there already. Look at Proverbs 28 and verse 7. Proverbs 28 and verse 7. Ahaz was many generations removed from King Solomon. So you know what he had? He had the book of Proverbs. Solomon wrote the book of Proverbs long before Ahaz was a twinkle in Jotham's eye. But apparently he didn't read these things. He was too busy hanging out with the kings of Israel. Proverbs 28 and verse 7. Says, whoso keepeth the law is a wise son, but he that is a companion of riotous men shameth his father. You see the contrast there between keeping the law and hanging out with riotous men. If you are a Christian endeavoring to keep the law of God, you don't hang out with riotous men. It doesn't make sense for Christians, whether they're adults or adolescents, to spend time hanging out with riotous men. Now, it's one thing if a person is a decent individual, but they're not a believer, right? And there are people like that out there. But riotous men, a Christian has no business having a friend like that and spending time with a friend like that. You're going to end up like King Ahaz if you do that. And there are people out there that are crazy enough to think that, well, if I go to the bar and I hang out with these partiers, that I can be the voice of reason for these people. And I can let them see a good example, you know, that I'm not doing what they're doing. That is a waste of time. And you are going to end up like King Ahaz if you adopt that idea. And I have a verse for you. This is so neat. I found this verse. I don't know. I have notes made by it already, so I don't know when I found it. I don't remember. I don't know if I've ever even used this verse in a sermon or not. I'm going to give it to you here in a minute. And this will prove the point that corrupt people will corrupt you, but you will not make righteous corrupt people. You will not let your righteousness rub off on them, but their wickedness will rub off on you. I've got an awesome verse for that just here in a couple of minutes. But first of all, turn to Proverbs 22 and verse 24. Proverbs 22, 24 through 25. It says, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man thou shalt not go. So what would be the reason for that? Why wouldn't we want to make friendship with an angry man? And why wouldn't we want to go along with a furious man? After all, well, they can just be angry. They can be furious. You know, it's not going to harm me. I can be friends with a fool. I can be friends with a guy that just flies off the handle and just starts knocking people out every time they upset him and just rails and screams at people and flips out. And I mean, that's okay. I can be friends with somebody like that, right? Verse 25. Lest, which means to prevent or guard against, lest thou learn his ways and get a snare to thy soul. You know what happens when you start hanging out with a guy that's quick to anger? You start to learn his ways, especially teenagers. I mean, the younger you are, the worse it is. I used to hang out with fools, and you know what? I ended up being a fool because I hung out with fools, and I ended up doing all kinds of horrible things that I probably wouldn't have done if I wouldn't have been hanging out with fools, because I was taught better than that. So you don't want to be friends with people like that. You'll end up walking in the ways of the kings of Israel. Now, here's the verse I was telling you about. Turn to Haggai chapter 2. This is really neat. Haggai 2, 12 through 13. This is, at least to me, I don't know, maybe you won't find it cool, but this is the coolest point, probably the coolest point of the whole sermon, in my opinion anyway. Haggai 2 and verse 12. It says, if one bear holy flesh, so he's asking the question here to the priests. He says, if one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or any meat, shall it be holy? And the priest answered and said, no. So if you have holy flesh and you're carrying it in your garment, and then your garment, because it's touched holy flesh, touches some other things, some other meat, bread, pottage, wine, oil, those things, will it make those things holy just because there was something holy in it? In other words, can some holy thing touching some unholy thing make the unholy thing holy? The priest says no. That holy thing touching that other thing is not going to make that other thing holy. Verse 13. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, it shall be unclean. Now, on the other hand, if the guy with his garment touches a dead body, and then he touches these other things, the meat and the oil and the wine, will they be unclean? Yes, they will. So, if the priest touched something clean, and then he touches something else, it doesn't change that other thing. It's not going to transfer its cleanliness, its holiness over to it. But if the priest touches something unclean, like a dead body, and he touches these other things, the uncleanness, the unholiness transfers over to it. You see that? That's the point. If you hang out with bad people, your goodness will not rub off on them, just like that garment was not going to make those other foods clean. But if you hang out with bad people, their badness will rub off on you. Their badness will make you bad, but your goodness will not make them good. That's just the way it works. But people will say, but Jesus hung out with publicans and harlots. Jesus hung out with repentant Republicans. I didn't even do that as a joke, believe it or not. Now that's funny. I don't care who you are. Jesus hung out with repentant publicans. It was the repentant publicans where I got Republican. That's where it, repentant publicans and harlots. You know, these were harlots like Mary, presumably she was a harlot, that was weeping and washing his feet with her tears. This was not a harlot that was in the middle of harlotry that Jesus was hanging out with. He was not hanging out with unrepentant, wicked tax collectors. He was hanging out with people that, like Zacchaeus, who were repentant tax collectors. You remember Zacchaeus? When Jesus came to him, Zacchaeus, the wee little man was he, climbed up in a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see, and as the Savior passed that way, he looked up in the tree and he said, Zacchaeus, you come down now, for I'm coming to your house today. Right? You remember the story if you grew up in Sunday school like I did. But anyway, that's what Jesus was doing. Jesus was not hanging out in bars with drunks in the red light district with whores and trying to let his goodness rub off on them. He was hanging out with repentant sinners, people that were coming to him for mercy. There's a big difference. Back to 2 Kings chapter 16 and verse 3. It says, he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, yea, and made his son to pass through the fire according to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord cast out from before the children of Israel. When Israel went into that promised land, the Lord told them, kill them all. Wipe these people out. Don't leave man, woman, or child left. Kill them all. And don't adopt their customs. And they didn't do it. They didn't kill them all. And what happened was they learned their awful, sinful ways. This man, Ahaz, was making his son to pass through the fire. He was offering his children to Moloch. And I'll give you the verse here. Leviticus 18 and verse 21. I want you to think about this. Do you realize that good King Hezekiah's brother was burnt in the fire to a pagan god? I don't know how Hezekiah made it through without dying, but his brother didn't. Leviticus 18, 21. Leviticus 18, 21. This shows you what a wicked king this was. If you burn your child in the fire, that's about as bad as it can get. Leviticus 18, 21. It says, and thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire to Molech, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord. Molech was a god that resembled an owl, as I've read anyway. I believe that was the god Molech. They have a similitude of the god Molech in the Bohemian Grove. I've actually seen a video of it. It's in California. That's where all the politicians and movers and shakers go every, I think it's July. They go out there and have some sodomitical orgy fests, according to the reports anyway. Old Richard Nixon, you can see him on tape, actually. He said the people that go to Bohemian Grove are a bunch of G-D-F-O-G-G-O-T-S. That's what Richard Nixon said about people that he ran with that went to the Bohemian Grove. And most of the big-time politicians have all been there. You can see pictures of them there. Alex Jones broke into that place years ago, or snuck into the place, and I watched the videos of them supposedly offering a fake human effigy in sacrifice to Molech. There's this great big statue, looks like a stout, like a owl. It's probably like 30 feet high or something. And you can look it up for yourself. It's online. You can watch the video. I'm not making this stuff up. And they burn this effigy in this wicker cage thing, and it's supposed to be a human sacrifice. Hopefully it's not, but with these people, nothing would surprise me. But anyway, that's Molech for you. Molech had an insatiable appetite for children to be burned in the fire. I read somewhere, I forget where this was. Might have been in the book Don gave me about the manners and customs of the Bible. I can't remember if that's where it was or it was somewhere else. That Molech, I guess, had hands that would stick out like this, and they would heat the hands up until they were red hot and then place the children in them. That's the sickness of these people. That's what they were doing, offering their sons to pagan gods. And this is, and Israel ended up adopting these customs. Psalm 106 and verse 35. Psalm 106 and verse 35. Let's go back to verse 34. They did not destroy the nations concerning whom the Lord commanded them. That's what I was just telling you a minute ago. They didn't destroy all the nations in the land of Canaan. They left some of them live. And they ended up learning their ways. Verse 36, and they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. They were trapped, they were stuck in this idolatry because of that. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils, and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they sacrificed unto the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. What a disgusting society to live in. And this was God's nation, God's church. They were burning their children in the fire, sacrificing their own children. We look at these heathen nations like the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Incas, and I don't know about the Aborigines, but anyway, a lot of these ancient cultures offered human sacrifice to the gods to make it rain, to give them crops, things like that. But you know, God's people, Israel, did the exact same thing, burned their children in the fire. Now, you might think that that's just unimaginable. How could that happen? That certainly couldn't happen here in America. Nobody would sacrifice their children in America. If you think that, you are wrong. Turn to Philippians 3 and verse 19. We still have a false god in this country that we sacrifice our children to. Let's call it our own belly. Philippians 3 and verse 19. It says, whose end is destruction, whose god is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who mind earthly things, whose god is their belly. Now, this is talking about people that are enemies of the cross of Christ. But here are people, this is my point, people whose god is their belly, right? Their god is their own desires and lusts. They want to make sure that they are satisfied. And we have millions of women in this country every year. I shouldn't say millions. We have about 1 million women in this country every year that sacrifice their sons and their daughters through abortion. Their god is their belly. They don't want children that get in the way of their blessed careers or their education or their hopes and dreams or whatever they want. They don't want the children to get in the way, and they sacrifice them in the fire. They do the exact same thing, only it's done in the womb and we don't hear the screams. That's all. It's just not done in the same manner, but the effect is still the same. Children sacrificed to devils. Look at Lamentations 4 and verse 3. Lamentations 4 and verse 3. Now, I think a lot of these poor women, I do feel bad for a lot of them. Some of them are just hard-hearted reprobates. I don't feel bad for them. I feel bad for their kids. But some of them, a lot of them, have been completely deceived by the media, by the school system, by Planned Parenthood, and the abortion clinics, that they don't even probably realize what they're actually doing. And that is sick. There's probably a special place in hell for people like that that deceive them. I have no doubt that Margaret Sanger's been burning for a long time, and she deserves it. She was the one that started Planned Parenthood. The eugenicist, racist, awful, ungodly, reprobate devil. That's what she was. Lamentations 4 and verse 3. Did you know that Bill Gates' father was the president of Planned Parenthood for a while? You can look it up. I saw an interview with Bill Gates, watched him say it with his own mouth, that his father was the president of Planned Parenthood. Might give you an idea of the spirituality of Mr. Gates if he's following in the footsteps of his father, and it appears that he certainly is. Lamentations 4 and verse 3 says, even the sea monsters draw out the breast. They give suck to their young, to their young ones. The daughter of my people has become cruel, like the ostriches in the wilderness. The Lord's saying here that even the sea monsters provide for their own children. Even the sea monsters will give their children suck, right? But the daughter of my people has become cruel, like the ostriches. Now, if you don't know anything about ostriches, you might wonder, well, what does that mean? Why would he refer to the women of the nation of Israel like ostriches? What, can they just run fast, right? No, it's not that. You look in Job 39, do a little comparative study, Job 39, and we'll see here why the Lord says that the people of Israel at that time were like the ostriches in the wilderness. They had lost the natural affection for their children. And this is a sign of the last times. Men should be lovers of their own selves. Proud, covetous, boasters, blasphemers, so on. In Romans chapter 1, it says, without natural affection. Job chapter 39 and verse 13 says, gavest thou the goodly wings unto the peacocks, or wings and feathers unto the ostrich, which leaveth her eggs in the earth, and warmeth them in the dust, and forgetteth that the foot may crush them, and that the wild beast may break them. She is hardened against her young ones, as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without fear, because God hath deprived her of wisdom. Neither hath he imparted to her understanding. The ostrich is so stupid that she puts her eggs in the earth to keep them warm, and then forgets where she put them, and steps on them and crushes them. But at least the ostrich isn't intentionally murdering her children. She's just too stupid to remember where they even were and steps on them. It's like pigs that accidentally roll over their piglets. You know, that happens if anybody has ever grown up on a farm, which I haven't, but I grew up around them and my dad did. And I'm well aware of pigs, that the big old sow just rolls over in her slothfulness and lands on one of her little piglets. And it dies. And you know what those cannibalistic swine do? Then they eat it. Well, Israel was pretty much the same way. Israel murdered their children in the fire. And then whenever things got very difficult because of their wicked sin, and the Lord sent in nations to besiege them, then they ate their children. And you can read about that. You can read about it prophesied in Deuteronomy 28, and you can read about it happening at different parts in the Bible. So yes, the people of our day have become like the ostrich in the wilderness, hardened against their young ones. They don't have natural affection for their children anymore. I've had people, it makes me so irritated. I did a video on why abortion's murder, and then I have these people coming back saying it's not murder, it's just a clump of cells. And you know what I tell them? I've told it to a couple of them. You're just a clump of cells, so can I take a forceps and crush your skull, suck your brain out, and then pull you out member by member, rip your arms and legs off, and then reassemble you on the table to make sure I got all of you? That's what they do to little babies, you know. And I'm not making this up. That's what they do. Oh, it's just a clump of cells. So were you, devil. These people make me angry. All right, so he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He made his son to pass through the fire. 2 Kings 13:3. According to the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. I want you to see what is connected with worshiping in the high places under green trees. Remember what we just read. He sacrificed his sons and daughters, or his sons, in the fire, and he worshiped under green trees. Green tree worship is pagan worship. It's been around forever, thousands of years. People have worshiped under green trees for thousands of years. You know what a green tree is? It's an evergreen, right? One that stays green all year long. It's like a Christmas tree, in other words. People have worshipped devils under green trees for thousands of years. And we still do it to this day. In fact, matter of fact, just a couple days ago, pretty much the whole country did. Look at Ezekiel 6 and verse 13. I'm going to show you this is devil worship. Ezekiel 6 and verse 13. Then shall ye know, Ezekiel 6:13, then shall ye know that I am the Lord, when their slain men shall be among their idols, round about their altars, upon every high hill, and in all the tops of the mountains, and under every green tree, and under every thick oak, the place where they did offer sweet savor to all their idols. They practiced idolatry under green trees. It's because green trees were a symbol of life and fertility. because they're alive. They don't ever die. They're alive. I mean, obviously, all trees, you know, trees don't die, but they look like they died, right? They shed their leaves and so on. But green trees never do. They retain their life throughout the year. So they're a symbol of life, a symbol of fertility. That's what all these ancient religions were sun worshiping and fertility worshiping. And really, they're one and the same thing. Sun worship is fertility worship because the sun, the pagans had surmised, is what gives life to the earth, right? Take away the sun, there is no life on earth. There's no heat, right? We'd all freeze to death. The sun is what gives life. The sun lands upon leaves and through photosynthesis, right, produces life in the trees and in the plants. And then we eat the plants, right? So the sun is the ultimate source of life as the pagans saw it. And they worshiped the sun. And they worshiped under green trees for the same reason. Just give you a few verses here. I'm just going to show you this is all through the Bible. 1 Kings 14, 23 through 24. 1 Kings 14, 23 through 24. Let's start with verse 22. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins which they had committed, above all that their fathers had done. This is talking about Judah. This is God's nation. This is not Israel. This is not the wicked nation that Jeroboam had corrupted and led into idolatry. This is God's nation, God's church. And they did evil. And here's what they did. Verse 23. For they also built them high places and images and groves on every high hill and on every green tree. They would build the groves and the altars on the top of the high hills, thinking that this is getting them close to God, right? That's why they would worship in the high places, as they were called. And when you get a green tree on top of a hill, that's the best place to worship, because now you've got, you know, two different aspects of idolatry. And look at what was connected with worshiping under green trees. Verse 24, and there were also Sodomites in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. So Israel not only learned green tree idolatry from the nations, Israel learned sodomy from the nations and did just like the nations that God had cast out of the land of Canaan before them. Well, look at America. Here we are, green tree worship for Christmas, and we're surrounded by sodomites, are we not? We're bombarded by them in the media. Everybody accepts it now. I say everybody. The vast majority of people accept it. And we are the hateful bigots because we hate it. Because it says the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. It says in Psalm 119, how does that verse go? That I esteem all thy precepts concerning all things to be right, and I hate every false way. We should hate it. It's an abomination. Let me get you the next verse here. Glad I wrote some of them down because I don't remember them all. 2 Kings 17 and verse 10, just over a page from 2 Kings 16. 2 Kings 17, 10. Look at what it says here in verse 9. And the children of Israel did secretly those things which were not right against the Lord their God, and they built them high places in all their cities, and from the tower of the watchman to the fenced city. This is what sinners do. They do their sin in secret, right? Didn't Paul say, just keep your finger there in 2 Kings 17. We'll get back to that in a minute. But turn with me to Ephesians chapter 5. I want to show you how sinners do things in secret. You ever notice that most sins are committed at night? And the Bible talks about this. The adulterer does his business at night. Most people, when they get drunken, are drunken in the night, Jesus said. Right? This is what sinners do. They like to do things under the cloak of darkness. Idolatry is the same way. It's done in secret. It's like the Masons. Everything the Masons do is done in secret. their buildings don't have any windows, or at least no windows from the main sanctuary, wherever they do their thing. Jehovah's Witnesses buildings, no windows. Strangest looking thing ever. Some of them even have like what look like window holes, but they're bricked over. You know what I call that? A prison. That's not a church, that's a prison if there's no windows. Beware of the religion that does things in secret. Paul said in Ephesians 5, 11 through 12, "And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them." This goes back to walking in the ways of the kings of Israel, right? That he that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. Evil communications corrupt good manners. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. You don't want to get involved in one of these churches that have occultic practices and occultic worship and false worship. Have no fellowship with them. Don't go to a Masonic temple just to see what it's all about. I did that when I was a teenager. I got to go. I actually sat in the worshipful master's chair. Now, there was no meeting going on or anything, but the guy that I was with was a past master. Well, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know the foggiest thing. I just thought Masons were just like a good old boys club or like the Lions Club or so. I didn't know anything about them. And there I am sitting in the worshipful master's chair and saying, "So what's this Masonic thing about anyway? You guys like the mafia or what?" That's what I asked him. "Oh, no, no. It's a charitable organization, don't you know?" Yeah, kid you not. Crazy experience. It wasn't long after that I found out the truth about it. Whenever I started asking certain things, and I was very careful because I knew it was a sensitive topic. Well, it was not well received when I started asking, "What's that G stand for on that symbol?" And you ever hear of Captain William Morgan? I asked him, what the origin of the Republican Party was? No. Said it was an anti-Mason party. That's what I read anyway. In response to Captain William Morgan when they drowned the guy, I think it was in Lake Erie. He exposed the first 3 degrees of Freemasonry, and so they exposed him to some fish. They put him down in the bottom of the lake. And there was a big uproar against that, and I think the Republican Party, although I think it was an anti-slavery party too, but anyway, I've heard that that's where it came from in the beginning. And really interesting, this is chasing another little rabbit here. I may have told you this before, but this is fascinating. Captain William Morgan's widow created some kind of an organization to expose the Masons because they killed her husband. And then, and this is up in New York State, and somehow she ends up getting connected with a dude named Joseph Smith, which was the founder of Masonry, or the founder of Mormonism. And then she goes with Smith and makes her way out west, and Smith gets to Illinois and goes to the Navajo Lodge. Is this, if I'm remembering all this stuff correctly, this has been a long, long time ago I read this. He gets to the Navajo Lodge, Masonic Lodge, and goes through and goes through all 3 degrees in like a weekend or something and becomes a Mason, and then says that the Lord had revealed to him the way to perfect Masonry, because Masonry had gone into disrepair, like Christianity had gone into disrepair, so Mormonism corrected Christianity, and it also corrected Masonry, and that's why Mormons have a lot of Masonic symbolism on their underwear and things like that, and they do a lot of things that are very similar to Masonic rituals, because they're basically Masons. Well, anyway, this woman, whose husband was killed by the Masons, ends up marrying Joseph Smith, who becomes a Mason. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. Anyway, back to Ephesians chapter 5 here. He says in verse 11, "Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them, for it is a shame to even to speak of those things which are done of them in secret." Even to talk about those things is a shame, Paul says. We are to reprove them. Now, to talk about them in exposing them, like I just did, I don't think that's what Paul's condemning here, obviously, to tell you, hey, don't join the Masons because they're a Luciferian organization, which they are, by the way. Morals and Dogma, which was written by Albert Pike, which was the founder of Scottish Rite Masonry, which is the rite that most Masons are in this country. the founder of that, wrote a book called Morals and Dogma, a great big thick book, and you can read in that book, and I've only heard excerpts out of it, I haven't read it, and I don't intend to, because it's Luciferian, but he says right in that book that Masonry is Luciferianism. He tells him flat out. He says that the God of this world, and that's what the Bible calls him, the God of this world, the devil, he thinks that Lucifer is the God of light, and Adonai, as he calls him, the God of the Bible, is the God of darkness. That's what they believe. The Masons believe that Lucifer is the God of light, and that the God of the Bible that we worship is the God of darkness, and is evil and wicked and bigotous and kills people and so on. That's what these people believe. Now, the people at the lower levels, in the first 3 degrees, they're just a bunch of dummies. They don't know anything. Most of them, I'm sure. Even though they take oaths where they're going to cut their throat from ear to ear and rip their bowels out and burn them and spread the ashes to the four winds and pluck their heart out of their chest. That's the oaths that they take for the first 3 degrees. I'm not making this stuff up. So you see these good Masons out there, and just think about those dudes walking into this building, like half covered up, like half their body's uncovered, half of it's covered, walking in there and saying, I am a lost soul in search of light, because that's what they do, and going through these degrees and promising that if they ever reveal the secrets of Masonry, they'll slit their throat from ear to ear, disembowel themselves, and so on. Just remember that. That's those good Masons for you. And all those nice, cute little Shriners, you know, the guy that run around in the Zemzems and the parades, the little three-wheeled things, they got the little thing with the fez on their cap, right? They have all the children's hospitals, you know, those good godly Christian men. You know what those good godly Christian men have to do first before they become a Shriner? Become a Mason. Become a 32nd degree Mason, as far as I remember. And you know what the Shriners take their oath on? The Quran. Good godly Christian folks, don't you know? Philanthropists. They love the children. It's a shame to even speak of those things which are done to them in secret. How long? Oh, I've been going over an hour here. Okay, we'll just finish up this verse, and then we'll finish up this study in 2 months from now. Oh, I didn't even get through. Wow, talk about rabbits upon rabbits. So let's go back to 2 Kings 17 and verse 10. We didn't even get to that verse yet. So they secretly did these things there in verse 9, 2 Kings 17:10, and they set them up images in groves in every high hill and under every green tree. And there they burnt incense in all the high places, as did the heathen whom the Lord carried away before them, and wrought wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger. And they served idols whereof the Lord had said unto them, ye shall not do this thing. They served the idols under the green trees, just like the pagan nations that had been cast out before them. Let me give you just a couple of more verses here and we'll be done. Look at Jeremiah 2 and verse 20. Jeremiah 2 and verse 20. But it was a bit of a rabbit, I suppose. But really, I'm talking about idolatrous religion here, and that's exactly what Masonry is. So it is all kind of connected. And by the way, I guess while I'm chasing rabbits with the Masonry thing, remember that the green tree worship, the high hill worship, was all Baal worship and sun worship, right? Baal is the sun god. Well, do you know that little emblem in Masonry? It's you've probably seen it before. It's the little round blue one. And it's got the compass and the, so it's got the compass like this and the square like this. I think that's what it is. And they're interlocking like this, so one over the other one. And then in the middle, in here, there's a G. Well, see, the compass, I think the compass is on top, pretty sure. The compass represents the sun, and the square represents the earth. And the sun's rays are penetrating and impregnating the earth. And this symbol is also symbolic of a man and a woman in union. Now the G, whenever they first get in the first degree, they tell them that the G means, I think the first one is geometry. Tell them it means geometry. Makes sense, right? Compass and square, whatever. And this is typical of Masonry. They tell you that the symbols mean one thing whenever you first get in, and then the deeper and deeper you get, then they it's progressive revelation, and they continue to reveal to you what you're actually involved in until you get way up to the top and they tell you, oh, by the way, you're a worshiper of Lucifer. That's what happens. Well, then they tell you that the G means God. Because, you know, the Masons are good Christian folks, don't you know? The G means God. But then once you get a little further along, then they tell you what G really means. The generative principle. Sex, in other words. Masonry is the ancient pagan sex cult religion stuff. That's what it's all about. It's about worshiping the generative principle. Worshiping nature. Worshiping the sun. Worshiping regeneration or generation. Human generation. So yes, it all kind of does tie in there. Turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 10. Oh, I never got to Jeremiah 2, did I? Jeremiah 2:20. And then we'll get to Jeremiah 10. Jeremiah 2 and verse 20. It says, for of old time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands, and thou saidst, I will not transgress, when upon every high hill and upon every or under every green tree thou wanderest playing the harlot. Well, I'm not going to sin, Lord. And then you go play the harlot under the green tree. That's what they were doing. Look at Jeremiah chapter 10. Love this passage, especially for this time of year. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 2. It says, thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, as the heathen are dismayed at them. You know where the history of Christmas came from, right? People looked at the heavens and were dismayed at the signs of heaven, because they noticed that the days continually got shorter. From June 21st, the days were the longest. The sun's the highest in the sky. Days are long, nights are short. And then, as the year progresses, the sun gets lower and lower and lower in the sky, and the days get shorter and shorter and shorter, until December 21st or 22nd, whenever the sun is at its lowest power. And the sun, the pagans concluded, had died at that point. And then, a few days later, they noticed that the days are getting longer, and the sun has been resurrected. And they would have a celebration of the rebirth of the sun. It was called Natalis Solis Invictus. The birth of the unconquered sun took place on, you guessed it, December 25th. You can look this up in the encyclopedia. And the Catholic Church just came along and took Natalis Solis Invictus and changed the name of it to Christ's Mass and said that it's the birth of the Son of God, not the sun in the sky. Problem is, God says, don't do that. Learn not the way of the heathen. Be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them, for the customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck, which means to decorate, they deck it with silver and with gold. Can you say tinsel? They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. Now this is referring to an idol, right? It is not specifically referring to a Christmas tree, though it sounds just like one. But people would cut a tree out of the forest, they would bring it back, they would carve it, they'd put silver and gold on it, they would fasten it with hammers and nails so that it would stand upright and not move, right? This is what it's talking about, an idol. Now, what is the difference between somebody cutting a tree out of the forest, bringing it into their house, decorating it with silver and gold, tinsel, hammering it down with hammers and nails so it doesn't fall over? It's the same thing. It's just a different type of idol, that's all. It's the same thing. People, you know, they like to try to say, this isn't talking about a Christmas tree. Well, if it quacks like a duck and it walks like a duck, then it looks like a duck enough for me. It's the same kind of thing. Especially when you have tons of verses about people worshiping under green trees, and people bring a green tree into their house, and what do? Get down on their hands and knees and start pulling out presents and being happy. Close enough for me. Go back here to 2 Kings. Got another verse for you, just one or two maybe. Just give you one more, Isaiah 57 and verse 5. Isaiah 57 and verse 5. Inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree, slaying the children in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks. You see how it was alluded to here in 2 Kings 16 that he made his son pass through the fire and he sacrificed in the high places and under every green tree. And we concluded from that since, you know, one comes right after the other and they're connected by and, that these things were happening together. But this verse just flat out tells us that they were happening together. Inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree, slaying the children in the valleys under the clefts of the rocks. They were murdering their children while worshiping under green trees. Now, people, like I used to think, oh, you know, God doesn't care. He knows what's in my heart. He doesn't care about it, you know, the Christmas tree, the green tree, because I'm not doing that. But you know what? God remembers. When God looks at that green tree, God remembers what? His people and what heathen people have done forever, how they murdered their children when they were worshiping under those green trees. And God hates that kind of thing. We may forget, but God doesn't. So this is what King Ahaz did. He learned the bad ways of the kings of Israel. I'm going to stop there for today, and then next time we're going to see the result of what happened here. Because right now we've just seen Ahaz's wicked sin. I mean, about as bad as it gets, right? But then we're going to see what the Lord does in response to that sin. And there's some really interesting stuff here that I'm going to be able to draw out of this in probably realistically the next probably 2 weeks. But maybe I can get through it next week. I don't know. But I'm going to say probably 2 weeks. So anyway, I hope this was, well, yeah, kind of a dreary sermon. But anyway, I hope it was an admonition for you anyway, an exhortation for you to learn not the way of the heathen and to be very careful who you follow and who you associate with, because this was Ahaz's downfall. He walked with the kings of the nation of Israel and he learned their ways. And we're going to see that the very people that he followed and that he learned from, the Lord used those very people to judge him. And that's quite interesting. So we'll talk about that next time, Lord willing.